Hello, Edwin Vera. Welcome to the Reality Report.
My pleasure to be with you.
Really, it is a pleasure to have you here today, and so much is going on in the world of the Second Amendment. You're definitely an expert in that. You've written numerous essays on it. We've published, we've been proud to publish a lot of your work in our publication, Republic Magazine. You know, I want to jump right into these topics because there are direct threats to the Republic. The Second Amendment was put in place to preserve the free state, and as we see, the free state is being threatened by the federal government. States are rising up. They're introducing sovereignty laws, you know, reinstating and reminding the federal government of the 10th Amendment. We see Montana instituting gun legislation to prevent federal firearms laws from affecting them. What do you think, Dr. Vera, is the single most greatest threat to the Second Amendment today?
Well, I think we're down on the same route that we have always been, because if you look at the Heller opinion, District of Columbia versus Heller in the Supreme Court, which many people thought was a great victory. Well, it was a victory for Heller individually, although I guess he's still fighting to get all of his personal gun rights in the district because they're attempting to stall with him as much as possible. If you look at a great deal of the language that appears in the majority opinion by Justice Scalia, what you see is primarily a whitewash of the entire structure of federal gun control laws in this country. And he goes out of his way to say that these are presumptively unconstitutional because none of them were actually involved in the case. He talks specifically about the National Firearms Act, 1934, which, for all intents and purposes now, with some later legislation, has made it practically impossible, if not legally impossible, certainly practically extremely difficult for the average person to get his hands on any kind of fully automatic firearm, such an M16.
Which piece of legislation is that?
Well, the National Firearms Act of 1934 is essentially where that started, because they imposed a tax and a transfer registration requirement on all fully automatic firearms. And then more recently, there was an act passed in the Clinton administration which stopped the production of new firearms of that type for private sale. So that what's happened is, in the first place, all of these things are registered out there, and then their supply has been cut off, at least for private parties, so they've driven the prices of them through the roof. So in any event, the Heller decision, Scalia's opinion for the majority of the court in the Heller decision, he goes out of his way to say, oh, well, there could be no question that this is constitutional. There could be no question that all of these other federal gun laws are presumptively constitutional. Well, that leaves us pretty much in the position that we were before the Heller decision came out. Yes, granted, someone like Heller may not be precluded from having a working firearm within his home to protect himself. But that's not really the test or the ultimate purpose of the Second Amendment. And on the other hand, all of these laws, at least in principle, Gun Control Act of 1968, the assault weapons ban that the Clinton administration passed, which expired of its own force, but they're already talking about bringing that back in. They're talking about registration provisions for all private firearms. They're talking about coding ammunition. You run down the list of these statutes. I can't see any one of those that looks as if it's outside of this rather compendious umbrella of presumptive validity that the Heller decision has given to the mass of federal gun control laws. So I don't think we're any better off as a result of having that decision in terms of what they can do sort of at the top level in terms of passing, out of Congress at least, in terms of passing some pretty stringent laws. The one thing that decision seems to say pretty clearly is if you happen to have a gun in your home now, they can't prevent you from maintaining it there. But as I like
so
to
it's
point,
like basically your grandfather didn't.
You're basically, so far, because we don't know, of course, they changed the composition of the court, they'll change the determination, perhaps even with respect to what Heller decided. But it reminds me of a decision that came out by the Supreme Court a long time ago called Stanley versus Georgia, in which an individual had pornographic material, material that had been determined to be pornographic within the state of Georgia in his home. Supreme Court upheld that on the basis of a First Amendment right to have information of essentially any kind in your home. But a few years later, when somebody claimed on the basis of that right that had been recognized in the Stanley case that he was entitled to bring pornographic material into his home, they said, oh, no, that's a different story entirely, and the government can stop you from transporting that. So you can imagine a situation where the Heller decision could gradually, yeah, perhaps quite quickly, be limited to this idea that, yes, you can have the gun in your home, but
you can't bring it into your home.
But you can't get into your home in the first place, or you can't take it out of your home, or we can prevent you from getting ammunition or whatever, so the gun becomes effectively useless in the long term. You can imagine that type of situation. I can imagine the people over in these gun control, private gun control organizations, already drafting this kind of legislation. I would know how to draft it. Wouldn't be any problem drafting that type of legislation. And they have a Congress now and a president that very well might go along with some of it.
Here's a question regarding the registration of firearms. And I believe, and I'd like to get your opinion on this, that the reason we see the increasing amount of legislation that is restricting Americans' rights to own firearms, to own a gun, is because the government and the politicians are really trying to preserve their own longevity by removing the ability of the people to secure a free state in the event of revolution. What do you think about that?
Well, I don't think it rises to the level of revolution. I think you look at the constitutional principle, and the Second Amendment begins a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state.
And that's what I mean, to secure the free state.
Right, but the constitutional principle there does not assume, I believe, that you're going to have constant revolutionary situations arising. The revolutionary situation is a Declaration of Independence type situation, where things have gone so far, they've become so bad, that there is no alternative other than some kind of armed resistance, because actually the other side is imposing an armed tyranny against you. I mean, that's the logic of it. But the concept of the militia structure was twofold. One, it was to have this huge body of armed and trained citizens as a deterrent, number one. You're not going to have usurpation and tyranny if the usurpers and the wannabe tyrants, if you will, are constantly looking over their shoulders at millions and millions of armed and trained Americans who are watching them. They're simply not going to be able to take that chance. And we don't believe, I certainly don't believe, that it's very easy to take something like the United States Armed Forces and turn it into a group of traitors and myrmidons, Praetorian Guard for some treasonous tyrant class. That is just, I mean, you hear those stories all the time. That's the fear down the line. But I don't think we have that kind of a standing army in this country, at least at this point in our history. So the militia concept was, number one, a deterrent concept. And then number two, quite obviously, it was to have people trained to deal with all sorts of emergencies, not simply the military-type emergency. And then number three, it was to have people organized on a constant basis, because the militia structure is compulsory. It's not voluntary. Everyone is required in some way to participate in it unless he gets a specific exemption. And when you're in that kind of an organization, meeting on a regular basis as they did for training, you're going to be discussing political issues, and you're going to be discussing ways to deal with those issues. You're going to be discussing who are the good political figures and who are the bad ones, who needs to be put into office and who needs to be removed from office, and so forth and so on. We don't have that today anymore. To the extent the American people are engaged in any of that kind of thought, to a very large extent, it's through institutions that the other side has created for us.
Right.
The two big political parties, the mass media, a lot of these other private organizations that they control, the think tanks, the universities, these are all their agents of influence and control of one form or another. And what the Constitution gave us as the ultimate agent of influence and control, the militia of the several states, which is the terminology the Constitution uses, simply for all practical purposes, not there.
Mm-hmm.
You can go into some states and find vestigial leftovers of militia structures. And in fact, you can find in some states, you take Massachusetts, Rhode Island, some of these Connecticut, the New England states in particular, they will have militia companies that date back all the way to the pre-revolutionary period. I think of the Artillery Company of Boston, the Artillery Company of Newport. You go to the Bristol Parade in Rhode Island on the 4th of July every year, and you'll see a lot of these people coming out to march in their colonial uniforms. Now, they're still there. They've been grandfathered in by the statutes that exist. But do they perform any of the true militia functions? Are they organizing the vast majority of the community? Are they giving us that educational and political and deterrent effect that the Constitution says is necessary to the security of a free state? Answer, no, 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 and no.
Right. So basically,
that's our problem.
Those institutions you spoke of are basically window dressing.
Yeah. Well, they're legitimate. I mean, if you trace the history back, they do, in fact, continue this authority that they originally had. But at the present time, they're entirely ceremonial, is what I would call it.
Right, ceremonial. It's like watching a Walt Disney parade at Disney World.
Or they may come out to, you know, for the governor or something and be an honor guard or you know, that type of thing. But they are certainly not even the nucleus of the type of structures that the Constitution says we need to have.
Right. Well, we've got a couple questions coming in here from our viewers, and let's see, we've got Diana in Los Angeles is asking, does the Second Amendment give us the right to carry concealed weapons without having to get permits?
Well, I would put it this way. The Second Amendment was designed to guarantee a particular kind of right, a right of the people to keep and bear arms that was conducive to this thing called a well-regulated militia. If you go back and study all of those militia statutes, and there are hundreds of them during the colonial period, and it's interesting that they're essentially all the same. They say the same thing again and again and again and again and again. The bear arms concept at that time was pretty open. There was no limiting definition that said they couldn't be concealed or they had to be open, they had to be long guns as opposed to handguns. No, no, and no. So I would say if we had a proper organized militia structure, the answer would be no, you would not need a permit to get a gun. You would not need a permit to carry a gun. Why? Because you'd be part of this structure in which it would be your duty to have a gun. That's what most people don't understand. The Second Amendment, when it talks about the right of the people to keep and bear arms and tying this to the militia, the well-regulated militia, is going back to a tradition in which nobody really talked about a right to keep and bear arms in the sense that we talk about a right as against the government. They were talking about a duty. Everyone had a duty to have a gun. And, of course, if you have a duty to have a gun, then some public official can't take it away from you, right? That's pretty obvious. I mean, the right follows from the duty. But their consideration at that time was this duty concept. And the statutes talk about that over and over again. You'll never see in one of these statutes, and I have never seen a colonial statute, that talks about a right to keep arms. They talk about a requirement to have certain kinds of guns and to keep them in your home, to buy them. Most people had to buy them themselves, and they had to keep them in their homes at all times, and they had to show them if the militia captain or sergeant or lieutenant, whoever was authorized to do what they called a sight, came to the home and said, let me see your gun and ammunition. Is this in working order? Okay, fine. If it isn't in working order, here's a fine for you. You were fined if you didn't have it or if it didn't work. If you didn't show up on training days with your firearms in proper working order and your ammunition and the other, they had other lists of equipment you had to have, you were fined for each dereliction. If you didn't have all 6 or 12 cartridges, there was a fine for each one of them that was missing. This was a serious matter.
It's totally different than what we see today, wherein you are punished if you haven't registered correctly or if you're not registered or you buy from someone else that's not a gun shop or something like that. The government, forgive me, are they doing this because they see the people as a threat to their existence?
Well, I think basically that's probably true. If you have a self-governing country in which the people are armed, who is the threat to whom? Well, by hypothesis, there is no threat to anyone. We're governing ourselves and we're armed. We're exercising what used to be called in political philosophy the power of the sword, one of the two great powers of government, power of the purse and the power of the sword. But to the extent that the people in public office see themselves as separate from and independent of and superior to the people, and then start doing things that they recognize as being antagonistic to the interests of the people, obviously their next thought is, well, wait a minute, we don't want these people to be in a position to remove us, maybe not electorally, or if we go too far, maybe not through the exercise of deterrence or eventually the use of force if you come to a Declaration of Independence type situation. And so the logic of the kind of the bureaucratic mind is, well, to the extent I'm going to consolidate power, I have to take away from those people over whom I'm exercising power their ability to resist me.
Mm-hmm.
And the ultimate ability to resist, the ultimate deterrent effect, number one, and then the ultimate resistance effect, number two, if deterrence fails, is that these people are armed and trained. I mean, that's just logical. It happens that you see this in society after society after society. As the societies essentially calcify, the governments become or think themselves independent, public officials, not really the government, the public officials, see themselves as independent and superior to the people, and they begin sort of putting around themselves a protective layer of police and, you know, Praetorian Guard syndrome. The next step, of course, if it hasn't already happened, is as much as possible to disarm the people so that they are totally dependent upon the government.
Right.
This is nothing new, and that's why. And that is why, if you think back to the Constitutional Convention, the federal, so-called Federal Convention, 1787, you think who was the chairman of that group? It was George Washington. And a number of other people were there who had served in the war. One of the, what I would say, most important ones was Alexander Hamilton, who had been an aide to Washington. And he was certainly an individual who was trying to make his influence felt in the convention, probably more than Washington, because Washington was sort of aloof and above things. But Hamilton was certainly trying to make his influence felt. Those two people, especially Washington, during the War of Independence, Washington wrote a number of letters where he was critical of the militias coming out of the 13 separate states. And it was essentially technical. He said, listen, these people were coming and they weren't as well trained as the Continental soldiers. They brought a whole mishmash of different kinds of arms with them. They didn't have necessarily uniform arms. They served for 30, 60, 90, 180 days, whatever their enlistment period was, and then they went home, right? They didn't want to stay. They left, so they were too independent, right? Many of them didn't have bayonets for their guns, so in the type of fighting that the British loved to do, which was close-quarter, cold steel-type fighting, the militia were not very effective or reliable. So this was his experience, and probably a lot of what he said was true, although there were many instances in which the militia did perform well. I mean, Saratoga is a good example. The campaigns in the Carolinas is a good example. But there was Washington's, let me say, his prejudice, if you will, against the militia. And I'll bet that Hamilton shared that prejudice in spades. And there were probably others in that Constitutional Convention who were certainly aware of the shortcomings of the militia. So you would have thought that in drafting a new constitution, they might have left the militia in some way for the states to deal with if they wanted to have a militia. But they wouldn't have made it a central part of the Constitution. And then when the Bill of Rights was enacted, they wouldn't have made it one of the most important, if not the practically most important, of all of those rights that's listed in the Bill of Rights. But they did. And the reason was not that they thought that the militia was some kind of highly efficient military organization. It was there for this ultimate political purpose, that he who holds the sword in the final analysis is the one who holds political power. Or as Mao Zedong says, and I think this is exactly parallel to the Second Amendment, political power comes out of the barrel of a gun. All right? Now, Mao was not talking about political power for the people. He was talking about political power for the party, right? Communist Party and his cronies. But the principle is correct. In the final analysis, government is force. It is not eloquence. It is force. And so who holds the ultimate force in society is the governing body of that society. And if you are going to have a self-governing republic, which is what we're supposed to have, a government where we the people rule, we the people are the sovereigns, which is what the Constitution says and what the Declaration of Independence says, right? All government derives from the consent of the people. If we are the sovereigns, then we are supposed to hold that sovereign power. All political power coming out of the barrel of a gun, we are supposed to hold those guns at least in sufficient number so that if push really came to shove, we would be able to assert or at least make a good showing of our sovereignty. Pretty simple. This is what's written right on the Constitution. It's not written in red letters, but it jumps off the page at you, especially when you put yourself back into the position of those people and realize what they had just gone through in the War of Independence, how that had started with the Battle of Lexington and Concord. And what was that all about? General Gage sent this flying column under Colonel Smith and Major Pitcairn to do what? Well, two things. First, they were going to try if they could and catch John Hancock and Sam Adams, who were two leading patriots, Hancock the richest man in New England and Adams the demagogue from Boston that Gage particularly didn't like. And number two, or maybe number one, was to seize the store of arms that they thought, Gage thought, was in Concord. They were coming out to disarm the American patriots. And the patriots took a look at this and said, this is the last straw. They've done a lot of other things, but when they come systematically, because Gage had done it a couple of other times, he had cleaned out a couple of other magazines, and he had gone and sent some troops up to Salem to attempt to do the same thing, and they had been turned back without any fighting. So Concord was like the fourth or the fifth time, I think, third, fourth, or fifth time that he had engaged in this plan. And at a certain point, the colonists said, patriots said, wait a minute, we've reached the tipping point here. This is the point at which talk, dialogue, discussion, argument is no longer going to be effective.
Do you see, I mean, people I talk to just on the street, at the gas station, total strangers, have brought up revolution to me. You know, and it's this is talk on the lips of the American people because they're completely fed up with the overreaching power of the federal government. They're fed up with taxes. They're fed up with the regulations. And do you see something like this happening on the horizon? Obama and Bobby Rush and all these cronies in the administration get their Second Amendment wishes fulfilled?
Well, let me put it this way. God forbid that there should be revolution, revolt, rebellion of a violent nature, because the reality of the situation always is when you open Pandora's box, you don't know what's going to come out of it.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Then that's a situation which all bets are off, in a sense. So you don't ever want the situation to get to that point. And, of course, the Declaration of Independence makes that point, right? That prudence will dictate that governments, what is it, long established, shall not be changed for light and transient reasons. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable. All right? People are disposed that way, and actually they ought to go to that extreme before they finally take up arms. We haven't yet tried. This is what I like to tell people. Said people have a lot of reasons, good reasons, for being critical of public officials, not simply in the general government, the government in Washington, but in a lot of the states as well. But we still have not tried some of the remedies, and in particular one remedy that the Constitution gives us.
And that is
a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. Now, the Constitution tells us that. It's the only thing the Constitution says is necessary for any purpose. The Constitution doesn't say Congress is necessary, the President is necessary, the Supreme Court is necessary. The only thing it says is necessary is a well-regulated militia, and for what purpose? The security of a free state, not a police state, not a garrison state, a free state, which is the reason for the Declaration of Independence and the reason for the Constitution. All right.
And it doesn't say federal government.
No, it says
correct.
A free state.
It's not speaking of the nation or the republic as a whole. It's talking about the individual state. Am I right?
Well, it's talking about state there in the political philosophical context. A state, a polity, as the Greeks would have called it, or as the colonial people call it, the government. When they talked about the government, what they meant was the whole political structure. It wasn't just those folks who were the governors and the members of the General Assembly in a particular state. If you were part of the government of a colony, if you were one of those people, essentially who was a voter, all right, you were part of the government. All right, so when they're talking about a free state, they're talking about this political concept, what we would call a self-governing republic, all right? That's another terminology for it. A republican form of government is another term the Constitution uses for it. But what it says to us is, it declares this, it's a matter of law. This is a legal declaration. It's not a matter of, you know, my idea or your idea. It's the Constitution telling us, the supreme law of the land, that this structure called a well-regulated militia is necessary if you people out there want to continue to live in this kind of a society. Period. Because there's no qualification, there's no exception, there's no ifs, ands, or buts included in the Constitution on that point. Now, if we look out the window, as it were, we see that we do not have a well-regulated militia in any state today. In
now, obviously, and I'm going to play devil's advocate for a moment here, because people have said, "Oh, well, it's the National Guard is the well-regulated militia." And how do we combat that? Because I know I've done the research in Illinois here, and I've watched the progression of legislation that shows how the state of Illinois has co-opted the militia and put it into the structure of the National Guard, and basically outlawed militias altogether. How do we work with this?
Well, if you look first historically, when was the national? What was the beginning of the National Guard? It was a statute called the Dick Act, named after Representative Dick, D-I-C-K, 1903. When was the Constitution ratified? 1788. You're trying to tell me that the militia didn't exist until 1903? Well, of course it did. One of the first statutes Congress passed, 1782, was the first Congressional Militia Act. But if you go back earlier, before the Constitution, because let's remember, the Constitution had a meaning before any statute was passed, before the first Congress sat. Constitution refers, before the Bill of Rights, refers to this set of institutions called the militia of the several states. What were these things? They were in existence in each one of the states. They had been in existence in those states or the colonies from the 1600s, 100 and something years, sometimes almost 150 years at the time the Constitution was ratified. We know precisely what those institutions were, because we can go back in each one of the colonies, and I have done this, and find all of the statutes that were enacted year by year for what they used to call settling and regulating the militias in each one of these colonies. And they have certain principles. In every one of the colonies, the same principles apply. Let's take a look at the National Guard. First thing, the National Guard is an adjunct of the standing army.
Right.
And in principle,
it's the National Guard. It's not related to the individual state.
Well, they have what they call in each state the component of the National Guard. They call it a state guard, a Virginia State Guard, a New York State Guard. But they're subsets of this thing called the National Guard. And it was created in 1903 for the purpose of having a very large reserve force for the regular army. All right? That was its reason for being. It was not to be a militia. Granted, they put it into a statute where they tried to call this thing a militia or following the militia principles. But if you look at the first principle of this organization, it's an adjunct of the standing army. And the whole principle of the Constitution, if you look at the structure of the Constitution, the army powers are separate from the militia powers. They're two separate groups of powers in the Constitution. The founding fathers say again and again, the militia is here as a check, potential check and balance against the standing army. So by hypothesis, if the militia could be made part of the standing army, you've defeated the whole purpose of the thing. It's self-contradictory and absurd. Secondly, this entity called, and this is not to degrade the National Guard, I mean, it performs a fine function where it's appropriate.
Well, I have friends who are in the National Guard,
sure,
and I respect them.
Nothing wrong with the National Guard in performing this function as a reserve component of the armed forces. But let's be clear of what it is. All right? Second point, if you look at the history of the militia and the meaning of that term, militia, the first principle in every militia statute during the what I call the pre-constitutional period, which gives us the definition of the term, was that everyone was a member.
Mm-hmm.
Compulsory service by everyone. Well, is everyone a member of the National Guard? No, it's a voluntary organization. I've never been a member of the National Guard. Maybe you haven't been a member of the National Guard. Nobody even asked me to be a member of the National Guard. Right.
Right.
Okay, now number two, the second principle of the militia was that every one of these members of the militia was armed with his own essentially military-grade firearm. They don't use that terminology, but they were military-grade firearms, which he himself purchased, unless he was too poor to do so. If he was too poor to do so, they'd arrange some other mechanism for him to get this gun, and which he then kept with an appropriate amount of ammunition and other stuff, bayonets and cartridge boxes, and they had a list of other equipment. He kept in his own home at all times, in his personal possession. Do your National Guard friends keep their M16 rifles in their own home?
I don't believe so.
I don't believe so. All right. The Swiss militia used to, until the leftists in Switzerland started attacking it. Every Swiss militiaman would have his fully automatic rifle and cans of sealed ammunition in his home at all times. Well, that was the second principle. Then the third principle was all these people would go out for training on a regular basis. Well, when was the last time I was called by the governor of Virginia to go out for training? I've never been called by the governor of Virginia to go out for training. Never. And probably you haven't been called by the governor of Indiana to go out for training, all right? So
actually, no.
No, okay.
Blagojevich never called me.
Okay, never called. Any of them would have called you. So we run down this list of principles. Let me give you the fourth one was, if I didn't do these things, or we didn't do what we were required to do, there was a series of fines that were applied to us. Now, I don't particularly like that idea of applying to me fines, but I know they're not there. Certainly in the Commonwealth of Virginia, if I just thumb my nose at the governor and say, I couldn't care less about the militia, somebody doesn't come around and fine me.
Right. Here's a question. I'm going to jump into this question. It's coming from, I don't see the name, but it says, with all the political corruption around this issue, how do we assert our duty without fear of losing our freedom?
Well, number one, you're already losing your freedom. So this goes along with the old principle of, how should I phrase this? Weigh a risk against a certainty. I've heard this so many times. Oh, my gosh, if we revitalize the militia according to constitutional principles, it might get into the hands of some rogue governor. Well, excuse me, you're already in the hands of rogue governors, right? It couldn't be worse than it is now. If you once reorganize this militia, or what I call revitalizing the militia, all of a sudden you're going to organize a lot of people who have not been politically organized before. And my guess is that those people, many of whom you talk to at the gas station who don't like what's going on in politics, if they saw themselves in an organization that now had legal authority to do certain things, and they saw themselves working on a regular basis with large numbers of their neighbors, co-workers, and so forth and so on in this area, we would see rather a quick change in the coloration of the typical politician, at least at the state level. I think that would happen very, very quickly because one of the principles of the militia was who appointed their officers?
Right.
The people themselves. Mm-hmm. The people in their own militia companies. And the Constitution maintains that situation by saying that other than the President of the United States, who is the commander-in-chief on the one side of the armed forces and on the other side of the militia when they're called into the actual service of the United States, all the other officers in the militia are state officers. They're appointed by the states in some way. So if you look at the militia as an entity in the federal structure, other than the president, the whole thing is centralized in the states. Talk about these state sovereignty resolutions, and I don't mean this to be pejorative, but in the reality of these things, as good as they are in principle, they are toothless paper tigers. Because they have no enforcement mechanism. Big deal if the state of X, Y, or Z tells the federal government that the 10th Amendment is still viable. They know that in Washington, but they don't care because the
right.
state can't do or won't do anything to enforce that resolution. The first state that comes along and says, oh, and by the way, we're also revitalizing our militia according to these constitutional principles. We have these two things. Then I think a lot of people in Washington are going to sit up and take notice.
Okay, so basically, and these resolutions that are coming along, 9th and 10th Amendment resolutions throughout the states, as you said, they don't have any teeth because they don't have any muscle to back it up.
Right.
So the Washington is going to go, okay, great, you know, you guys can pass resolutions all day, we don't care, we're going to go around you anyway. And so you're saying the revitalization of the state militias would provide the essential backing for these sovereignty issues. And do you see this as the Committee to Safety fulfilling this role?
Well, I look at these groups, and I'm not sure which committees of safety you're talking about. When I started,
the Walter Reddy's committee.
Those people. What they're trying to do is what I have recommended to people, which is to form citizens activist groups within the states. They're calling the committees of safety. You could call them what I call them in my book, Citizens Homeland Security Association. Call them whatever you want, as long as you don't call them militia, because they're not militia. They can't be militia until there's a state statute passed, and I mean, it has to be regularized according to constitutional principles. But the purpose of these groups is to organize, educate, find those people in the legislature who can be educated or who are already on the same page. Take a good look at what needs to be done in your particular state, because each state will have a somewhat different homeland security problem. I mean, Arizona has obviously a basic problem with illegal immigration, which maybe Iowa doesn't have, all right? But Iowa may have problems with natural disasters because they get tornadoes out there on a regular basis. So you have somewhat different homeland security issues, and that has to be fed into the final statute that's created, because the militia will need to be structured to deal with each of those issues.
You know,
get a statute drafted. This is the ultimate purpose of this. Get a statute drafted. Don't wait for the legislature to draft it. Draft it from the people and hand it to the legislature. This is what we want enacted. We have 20,000 people who signed petitions. Oh, and by the way, of those 20,000 people, 5,000, 6,000, 8,000, whatever the number is, have agreed that when this statute is passed, they will volunteer to start performing these militia functions, whatever they might be.
I see. Where can we find legislation like that? Do the Committees of Safety website have that, or do you
know? I am working on a number of things here, and one of them, slowly but surely, is a model bill. At least it'll be a model for any state that operates on a county government basis, because I'm drafting it using Virginia as the example, and Virginia is essentially a county government basis. If you have a town basis, it may be different. If you have, I guess, a state like Connecticut, where a great deal of it comes directly from the central government in Hartford, would have it be tweaked a little bit. But it's the type of thing that any good legislative draftsman who knows his own state code ought to be able to take and modify to fit the code. And there's the only practical glitch in this system, is that every state will have a separate part of its statutory code that deals with these types of questions. So if you go to Virginia, there's a thing called the military laws, which has the National Guard and so forth. And so you have to devise the statute in such a way that it fits in to your state code.
It fits into the existing, right,
state code. Yeah.
We've got a question here from Hugh in Lakewood, Ohio. You know, he's frustrated, much like a lot of Americans, as we saw in the last time we reached out and spoke to our congressman about not supporting the bailout bills. Hugh's concerned that Congress is not listening to the people. And do you have any ideas on how we can change that?
I think the only way to change that is for the people to gain control in one or two states to begin with, put in some of this fundamentally important remedial legislation, starting off with the 10th Amendment-type resolution and then following that on with legislation that actually puts teeth behind it, enforcement behind it, and then show to those people who are in Congress or who are running for Congress that the day of their having complete independence, where they can thumb their nose at the American people, is over, because things are going to be done in the states whether they like it or not. Because we're talking about powers that the states have independently of Congress.
Right.
Certain things can be done in the states. Congress can hem and haw and huff and puff, and that's just too bad. Because the states really don't need to concern themselves with Congress. And in fact, I look at the situation of a militia revitalization. The only thing Congress could do, in a sense, would be to ratify it by acting under their own constitutional powers to to, among other things, arm the militia. I mean, that's their constitutional power, to arm the militia. So if they would like to give a state militia better guns than it has, I guess the states would say, yeah, sure, send them. But don't tell us that we're not going to have this structure, because
right.
the Constitution says that we're supposed to have it. Now, I'll give you another example. If you had a complete militia structure, at least where where the statute said that everyone was a member and had a duty to perform minimal functions, and you made one of the duties, the requirement, that every member of the militia have what I proposed as an alternative currency system in some of these state bills that are floating around, an electronic gold or silver account, you could take that whole state off the Federal Reserve currency system literally overnight. And there would be nothing Congress could do about it because, number one, they don't have anything in the statute books to prevent you from doing it. But number two, if they try to prevent you from doing it, the short answer would be, well, all of these individuals are acting as essentially functionaries of the state. They're all acting in the capacity of instrumentalities
well,
of the state.
Is this a state action? I spoke to Congressman Paul. I asked him about the ability for states to print their own money. He said that they can't do that.
No, we're not talking about printing money. We're not talking about coining money.
Okay.
A state can adopt as money any gold or silver coin it wants, or it could adopt in these electronic systems its bullion that's there and it's just being transferred electronically. Those do not involve coining money or, as the Constitution calls it, emitting bills of credit. That's what they call printing paper money, emitting bills of credit.
Yeah. So basically adopting a secondary currency system.
Yeah, that's right, an alternative currency system. There's absolutely nothing that stops them from doing that. In the same way, there's absolutely nothing that stops me from doing that. And the Supreme Court already ruled on this. This is what's fascinating to me. The people have lost all of its history. They don't bother to open the books anymore. If it doesn't appear in Wikipedia or you're on Oprah, they think it doesn't exist. This exact issue occurred after the Civil War because Congress had put out, as I think everybody remembers, I hope, the Lincoln Greenbacks, which is the source of the color of our Federal Reserve note today, came from these currency, this paper currency that came out during the Lincoln administration, the Civil War. And this was the first legal tender paper currency that had ever been emitted under the general government. Well, for a period of time, that currency was not redeemable in gold or silver because the government had gone off the payments system, payment of gold and silver, during the Civil War. Right? So there was a period of time even after the war, between 1865 and 1875, when this stuff was floating around but not redeemable in gold or silver. But at the same time, there was gold and silver currency that had been and was being generated by the Treasury being used. So you had parallel money systems. You had irredeemable paper currency on the one side, and you had gold and silver coinage on the other side. And a couple of cases came to the Supreme Court, which in the first one being a case called Lane County versus Oregon, in which the state required that taxes be paid in gold and silver coin. And a taxpayer wanted to pay in these legal tender notes, which were depreciated relative to gold and silver coin. And he said, well, I'm entitled to do that because Congress has made these things legal tender for all debts, public and private. That's the exact language out of the statute, legal tender for all debts, public and private. And the Supreme Court said, wrong. A state retains a certain amount of its sovereign authority. It's given some up in the Constitution, but it retains the rest. And one of those sovereign authorities is the power to tax. Another one would be the power to borrow, the power to spend on government projects. You can come up with a list of these things that are characteristic government powers. But this particular case involved the power to tax. And it said if a state decides that it's going to be collecting taxes in a particular medium of exchange, Congress has nothing to say about it. Congress's power does not extend to that. So you could have a state taxing in oyster shells. Maryland used to do that way back when. You had a lot of states taxing in kind, certainly in the colonial period and even shortly thereafter, because there wasn't that much money floating around. So there's absolutely no reason why a state today, as long as the state itself is not coining money or not emitting bills of credit that is making up its own paper money, that a state could not adopt something else as its medium exchange.
Okay, I understand that. We've got another question coming in here regarding licensing about gun licensing. It's coming from George in Massachusetts. He's asking, once people apply for licenses, aren't they a subject by consent to their rules?
Which rules? I mean, if he's talking about...
I'm assuming the rules of that would require compliance with the license.
Well, that's right. If the license has a set of particular requirements, let's take an example here in Virginia. If you have a concealed carry permit, you cannot take a firearm concealed into a bar, even if you don't drink. If you're just going in there and sitting at a table and drinking soda water, you cannot have a concealed firearm. The peculiarity of Virginia is you can walk into that same bar carrying a Hopalong Cassidy double holster, as long as it's completely exposed, and sit at the bar drinking shots of whiskey, and it's perfectly legal. Doesn't always make sense, right? So, okay, I'm just telling you, doesn't always make sense. I would be a lot more worried about the guy sitting there at the bar with a Hopalong Cassidy outfit drinking those shots than I would that the fellow sitting in the next booth to me might have a concealed gun. All right. But in any event, it's certainly peculiar. And he's correct. When you take that license, you take with it all of these other limitations. But if you're looking at this from some ultimate constitutional point of view, well, they are coercing you into taking this license because there's no other way that you can exercise the constitutional right, perhaps, to defend yourself on a city street. All right, with a
this takes us to another question here. Does having to get any sort of permit make the Second Amendment pointless?
Make it what?
Make it pointless.
No, because the permits are, to a very large extent, I mean, I suppose we could imagine some in a militia context that would be legitimate. But certainly the permit systems that you see out there now are unconstitutional. I mean, our problem is not that somehow they've set the Second Amendment aside. They're violating it.
Right.
You know, I hear this all the time. Well, you know, the Constitution is no longer effective. It's a baloney. They're violent. I mean, bank robbery, laws against bank robbery are not ineffective because a lot of bank robbers are successful in holding up banks. What they tell us is we need more police, or we need better bank guards, or we need better alarm systems, or whatever. It's not that the laws are bad ideas. It's that we haven't done the necessary enforcement. Same thing is true with our Constitution. We have all sorts of provisions in the Constitution that the politicians just spit on. Whose fault is that? Well, it's our fault. We're the ones who are supposed to be in control.
You know, I'd like to see a bill introduced. I mentioned this on an earlier show, that a bill that would require or actually put some accountability in place for people that violate their oath of office if they vote contrary to the Constitution. I would love to see something like that. Maybe you could work on some legislation. We could get it out to the people. That'd be a beautiful thing.
Well, the legislation's already there. It's look in Title 18 of the United States Code, if we want a federal statute. Title 18 of the United States Code, there are two of them. Section 241 and 242, criminal violation of civil rights. Any individual who takes an oath of office to the Constitution and then knowingly, willfully, and intentionally violates that oath, as, for instance, by enacting some piece of unconstitutional legislation or enforcing some piece of unconstitutional legislation, has violated those provisions with respect to every person to whom that legislation or that application applies. It's there. If I were the Attorney General of the United States, we'd be running these people through the courts like sausages in a sausage factory.
Title 18, Section 242.
241 and 242. 241 deals with conspiracy to violate civil rights, and 242 deals with just the plain run-of-the-mill individual violation of civil rights.
So can the people call out their congressman or their representative and say, look, you're in direct violation of Title 18, Section 241. We want you out.
Well, you can say it. And then, of course, they look around and say, well, if you don't have the ability to vote me out, the Attorney General of the United States is not going to send someone from the Justice Department to indict me, so I guess I don't have to worry.
We the people can't institute some type of a legal remedy, you know, by civil going to the judges, going to the courts, even though the courts are corrupt, as we know, in collusion with all the corruption. Can the people introduce any type of legal remedy?
No, your remedy in the courts is usually to defend against the application of the statute or regulation to you. And then you can claim the statute or the regulation is unconstitutional. But that doesn't get back to the people who put it in. So let's imagine a situation where some regulatory agency comes after you with they claim you violated some statute, and so they're bringing an indictment against you in a criminal court of the United States, criminal indictment court of the United States. And so you defend that criminal charge by saying the statute's unconstitutional, the regulation's unconstitutional, the people who are enforcing it are acting in violation of the Constitution, fine. You're acquitted, or the case is dismissed, whichever. You win that case. Does that do anything to those people? Well, maybe yes, because maybe now they're not going to try to enforce that regulation. But what you find is a lot of these federal agencies, if they lose a case in one circuit, because we have a number of different federal circuits around the country, if they lose a case in one circuit, they say, okay, well, we can't enforce it in the Ninth Circuit, but we'll still enforce it in the Seventh and the Sixth and the Fifth and so forth and so on. They kind of shrug their shoulders until it finally gets to the Supreme Court. And then as we saw in the Heller case, it gets to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court declares the D.C. regulations unconstitutional, and they turn around in D.C. and just pass some new regulations.
It's a never-ending battle.
It's a never-ending battle until the people get the deterrent effect so that we actually have prosecutors here who will take those individuals in the legislature or in the judiciary or in the executive branch of government and indict them for these violations of constitutional rights.
Well, it's definitely time to institute criminal charges against these people who are violating our constitutional rights. Edwin Vera, I want to thank you for joining us on this edition of the Reality Report. It's great to have you, and we want to have you back in the future. Your wealth of knowledge is really enlightening, and I know our viewers are benefiting greatly from your education today. So thank you for joining us.
Sure, hope to talk to you again. Right. Bye-bye.
Doctor, Edwin, you still there?
I think he's history, Gary.
Okay. We should probably get him back. Just a moment.
I think he actually thought that you were finished.
Right. Hang on a second. So we got to get some more questions in here. I'll get him on the phone here.
And just while we're waiting to get the doc back on the phone, just want to let everybody know that's out there that you can get a hold of that free ammunition reloading guide that we spoke about yesterday on the call. There's a link on the webpage, or you can go straight to that website. It's ammunitionreloadingsecrets.com. There's actually a full book that's been put together as part of a course. If you're interested in actually learning how to reload your own ammunition so that you can save yourself from having it identified and tagged by the federal government if these bills end up going to the state legislatures and passing, you can go to ammunitionreloadingsecrets.com, and he's actually given away this whole course book for free, which is amazing. I've looked through it. It's got so many resources, and I would say it's better to have it than to not have it. So ammunitionreloadingsecrets.com is his website, and definitely read it. And it'd be great if you told him what you thought of the book, too, to give him some feedback, because I'm sure that he would like to hear that as well. And Gary's still working on...
Yeah, I'm calling him right now.
Okay, great. The other thing I want to make sure everyone knows about is the magazine that we just pre-released this last month, Don't Tread on Me, is all about the Second Amendment and these type of issues. It's very... Actually, it's not even important. It's our duty, in my opinion, to get this information out to people, whether you send an email with a digital copy that we give away for free or you can get copies of these things. You know, us doing these type of events and doing these type of webinars and conferences is solely supported by getting these magazines out to people. So we got to make sure that we get as much of this information to people as possible. And this is a way that you won't look like a wacko talking about a militia and talking about arming yourselves and revolution. You can let the magazine talk for you. And people will actually pay attention to that sometimes more than they pay attention to somebody that's just talking about these type of things. So I urge everybody to go right now to republicmagazine.com and get the stack of magazines before we're done with these and out. But we need to get them all out before the end of this month. because it's a very important issue, and we did 30,000 copies of this so that we can get these at least distributed to people and get them circulating. We need everyone's help with that. Gary, any headway?
Yeah, I just called him. He's going to call back in a minute. He had to change phones.
Excellent.
I love talking to him. He is just, he's so much information, you know.
I'm going to extend our webcast here a little bit so that we can get a few more questions in. So this recording will be available, too, so everyone knows after the fact, but only for a limited time at republicmagazine.com/webinar. So you can send an email out to other people and let them know they can come and listen to this. But they need to listen soon because this is not going to be available for the entire time we're going to be out there. We'll probably archive these recordings and put them up in some kind of a folder or password-protected area so people can get access to them later.
Hello. Dr. Bier, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, George, you want to go?
I'm fine, actually. If you want to continue, go ahead. Gary?
George, can you field some questions?
I guess I could. Let's see here. Larry in Milford, Ohio is asking, does the doctor propose that the government will tolerate the formation of these militias? Will they just quash it by labeling them as potential terrorist organizations?
Well, let's go back one step. Who's the government in this country? We are. I'm concerned with what we will tolerate, not with what some public official who is our agent, supposedly, will tolerate. They're not in a position to say what they're going to tolerate or not tolerate. Right? That's number one. We have to get a different mindset about this. But number two, my proposal, at least, is not to do what some people out there are doing and have been doing, forming private groups that they call militias because they have camouflage outfits and guns and they're practicing tactics in the woods or whatever. That's not the constitutional pattern. The constitutional pattern is a state structure based upon a state statute that follows a set of specific principles that can be absolutely documented from American history. So if what people are doing is joining activist groups that would be exercising their First Amendment rights of freedom of speech and freedom of association, and the purpose of this is to educate other people, to make contact with legislators, and so now you're talking about freedom of petition, to draft a statute, which I take it anyone in this country has an absolute constitutional right to do. They cannot tell you not to draft a statute and to hand it to some legislator to enact. And if the legislatures enact these statutes pursuant to public demand, because you've organized enough people at the grassroots level to make it apparent to the legislators that they will not be there after the next election if they don't put this kind of legislation into place, and the legislation is based entirely on constitutional principles which can be validated historically with no question whatsoever. I mean, I've looked into all of this. There is no question whatsoever. Exactly how are they going to say that this is some kind of extremist or whatever language that you want to apply? I mean, they may say it, but it's perfectly within the political process. And, in fact, it's demanded by the Constitution because the Second Amendment says a well-regulated militia is necessary to secure a free state. So I'm not too worried about that. Yes, you'll have the big media. Yes, you'll have some of these tendentious private organizations. Yes, you may have people in fusion centers or in the Department of Homeland Security talking through the side of their mouths that this is not whatever, not good, not American, not fair. Who knows what kind of language they're going to use. And I say, so what? If enough people do this in any particular state, it's going to happen. If enough people do it in enough states, it's going to happen. The reality of our political system is, at the bottom line, it is a majoritarian system. I know we call it a republic, but it is a democratic republic. The majority will rule at some point, at least in terms of getting statutes enacted. And the ultimate democratic institution in this country, believe it or not, is the militia. It's the one institution that includes everybody. The Republican Party, the Democratic Party, you know, whatever political parties we've ever had in our history, none of those parties was compulsory. None of those parties, they would have liked to have everyone in them, but none of those parties ever came close to having a supermajority in this country. The militia is the one absolute democratic system because it includes everybody. And if you get enough of those people organized, then the political class, the professional politician, if you will, the career politician, is going to have to sit up and take notice because his career will be absolutely dependent upon conforming his behavior to the will of the people, which is self-government. That's the definition of self-government. And the ones that don't conform, they'll be removed by election. So we're not even talking about these theories of indicting them and criminally charging them. They simply won't be there anymore. They'll be off working at Starbucks, making lattes or something. Those people will simply not be part of the problem any longer.
Fred in New Jersey is actually asking, he says, short of using the militia, is there any way to enforce constitutional rights when voters fail to elect officials that don't care about these rights?
Well, other than going through the judiciary, I mean, you have two routes of petition. There's your First Amendment right? Freedom of speech, try to educate people, make your political position known. Freedom of association, same thing, get together with others who think the same way. And then freedom of petition, and freedom of petition is the initial mechanism. If you see something going wrong in the government, you can go to the legislators and ask them to pass some remedial legislation or to repeal bad legislation or pass good legislation, whatever, but to do something that's consistent with the interests of the people in a constitutional fashion. Or if they pass bad legislation, then in principle you have another right of petition, which is to go to the courts when there's a particular case, because you can't just go to the courts, you have to have a case involved, and challenge in some way the validity of that legislation. Now, he says, the caller says, well, short of going to the militia, yes, we have these other routes, but what we've seen happen is the corruption in the political system has spread beyond the legislatures into the judicial system. And it is a very rare situation indeed where you have some major, say, federal program being declared unconstitutional. As I said earlier, the Heller case is a classic example of this. They declare this one little piece of the District of Columbia's regulations invalid, and in the course of writing this opinion, they tell us, oh, well, all the rest of this federal legislation is just hunky-dory. Wait a minute. What D.C. is doing is essentially a spin-off on the same principles that are applied in this federal legislation. How can what D.C. is doing be bad, and yet all of this federal legislation must be good? What, are we living in an insane asylum? We can think of, believe two contradictory ideas at the same point in time? So you see, my experience in the courts, and I spent too many years in the courts, is that it's very, very difficult for them to deal with, or they're reluctant to deal with what I would call the big principle issues. They want to deal with some little narrow point of law and not challenge kind of the establishment view of things. And the establishment view of gun control is that they can control anything they want by passing a statute or passing some regulation out of the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms or some of these other agencies. The constitutional view of gun control is that everything that they have there now is invalid. That instead of them telling you you can't have a gun, if they were doing their constitutional job, they would, A, be telling you that you have to have a gun, B, providing you with a gun, and C, training you with that gun. The thing is completely upside down. And that is the result, actually, the failure here is not the failure of the politicians, because politicians, generally speaking, will take the easy way out. They'll seek the most amount of power and prestige and make a career out of the thing. I don't think it's even a problem in the judiciary, because where does the judiciary come from? They're appointed by the politicians. Of course you're going to get judges that will agree with the people that appointed them. Let's be realistic about this. The failure here is on the part of the sovereign. And who is the sovereign? The people of each state or the people of the United States collectively. We have fallen down on our job in many, many ways. And to my mind, after studying this for years and living with it for many, many years, my conclusion is the biggest way that we've fallen down is we haven't maintained these structures called the militia of the several states, which would have kept us organized and, as it were, in the picture on a 24-hour-a-day basis. See, now what do we worry about? We worry about an election when it comes up, every 2 years, every 4 years, or at the Senate, or every 6 years. Maybe we worry about a piece of legislation that's particularly obnoxious, gun control statute that they're proposing to put in. All right, we get very exercised about that, and we call our congressmen or our state representatives or what have you. But then the next day, if the thing is defeated or even if it passes, we're back to square one. The picture that comes to my mind is you lift the lid off the garbage can, and that movement stirs up all the flies inside. And then if you watch them for a little while, they settle back down. And that's the same way we're operating. Something has to happen before we get energized. And then we go back to our lethargy. Whereas the concept of the militia structure, this constant participation, there is no lethargy. You're always vigilant. And who was it? I think it's Franklin said something along the lines of, constant vigilance is the price of freedom. You can't do it just every 2 years for a couple of weeks during an election season. It doesn't work. It's been proven not to work.
Now, if the courts don't listen and we end up going to this militia structure like we're talking about now, how do we avoid Waco-type standoffs?
Well, number one, I think the Waco-type standoff, again, we're looking at an extreme situation there, and deterrence is going to be the effect. I mean, you have something along that line, some rogue federal officials show up and say, well, they're going to do such and such and such and such to these people, and your local militia structures. And remember, we're talking about people now in a militia, state militia, that are authorized by state law. These aren't private individuals walking around with guns. They're officials of the state. And the lieutenant, county lieutenant, because that's what they used to call these people in many places, the county lieutenant, who's the head officer of the militia, when that ATF group shows up there, he says, what are you here for? And they say, oh, we're going to conduct a raid on such and such a place. And they say, no, you're not. Show me the documentation. We'll send some people in there to talk to Mr. Koresh about this and see if we can't bring him out. If you have a warrant for his arrest or something, we'll deal with that. But we're not going to have shootouts in, Okamoka County. And just tell me what those ATF agents are going to do when in Okamoka County they have 10,000 militiamen. They're going to do nothing. They're going to hand the papers over like good officers should and let the state officials deal with the problem. And if it turns out that Koresh or whomever says in his building, oh, I'm going to shoot it out to the last bullet, okay, then it may go in that direction if we're dealing with that kind of a person. But otherwise, you're not going to have these kinds of situations. I mean, look what happened in Ruby Ridge. At the very end of it, who was it? Bo Greitz shows up after all the shooting, after the boy had been killed and the mother had been killed, and he talks Randy Weaver into surrendering. Couldn't they have sent Bo Greitz in there to begin with? I would think so. If they had a militia structure up there in Idaho, wouldn't they have sent somebody in there to talk to him, talk to Randy Weaver to begin with? Would there have been any killing at all? Of course not. We assume not. I presume not. This is the difficulty. You don't have the system of checks and balances here. Militia structure is one element of the checks and balances system. What we're seeing happening is the police agencies, sheriff's departments, law enforcement in general, emergency services people in general in the states, are being more and more tied in to the federal government, to the Department of Homeland Security, especially through the purse strings, money, grants being given to them. And with money comes control. That's the problem. They're slowly but surely centralizing, federalizing, paramilitarizing these state agencies. And more and more control is being lost by the average citizen in his state and locality. And more it is being centralized at the top of some pyramid in Washington where some incompetent bureaucrat is pressing the buttons. Well, look at the picture. Is this what people in this country want? Do they want one Katrina situation after another? Every time you have a natural disaster, some fool comes in from Washington and blunders. I would assume not, right? Do they want to have a situation where potentially you have pandemics coming across the border from Mexico because the borders aren't sealed, and the person who was the governor of Arizona for years and couldn't seal the borders or didn't want to seal the borders, says now they have the Department of Homeland Security? I mean, this is something like out of Alice in Wonderland. You couldn't write this in a novel and have it believed, but there it is. And it's all because the people of this country are sitting on their hands watching football games and Oprah and American Idol and the rest of this nonsense instead of getting out and performing their functions as self-governing individuals. As I like to say, self-government is not a spectator sport. It is a team effort. It requires more than just a few people here and there going on the internet and complaining about what's going on in Washington or what's going on in the state capitals. It requires people getting together to change those situations. Right now, we can't change the situation in Washington. It's just too complicated. You can't get control of enough of the electorate throughout the country to get a what I would consider to be necessary, a supermajority in Congress, because if you don't also have the president can veto bills, and then the veto has to be overridden, so it's not enough to get a bill passed. You'd have to beat a veto as well. We simply don't have ourselves well enough organized to get that kind of control over Congress. So we have to go to essentially the next best level, and it may be the best level in one sense, the state governments. We have 50 shots there. It's not rolling the dice for, you know, one time. You have 50 different times, 50 different shots. And some of the states, it probably is perfectly conceivable that you could get control of those legislatures and pass some of the needed legislation. And once it passes in one state or two states, three states, some small number of states, if it really does what I think it would do, and I'm not talking just about the militia-type statutes, but monetary, alternative monetary statutes, some other things we can think of, the rest of the country is going to look at that and say, well, wait a minute, why should Montana or why should Oklahoma, why should these people be favored? We can pass that same kind of legislation ourselves. And you'll see it spread across the country like oil and water. And once that happens, what can Congress do about it? The short answer is nothing. They have to conform to what's happening in the rest of the country, or they will find themselves out of office. They'll simply be diselected. But it eventually comes down to the bottom of the pyramid, if you will. It comes down to Ma and Pa Kettle, average American. Some critical mass of those people, granted with a certain amount of leadership and a certain amount of education, type of thing that I hope programs like this are producing. There'll be some of that, but there has to be a critical mass of average people who are willing to get up and do something. If all it is to call a legislator, if all it is to sit down with their neighbors and try to educate somebody else so that the word spreads, if all it is making sure that they vote in an intelligent fashion, and all of it with one goal in mind, in each state, taking control of that state by the people.
We've got time for two more questions, and this ties in perfectly with what you're saying. How does one go about setting up a local militia if they don't know of one? And is there a registration process with the state to be called the state militia? Is there any kind of
okay.
How the whole process works?
I certainly do not recommend that anyone attempt to set up a local militia. These groups out there that have called themselves militia are private organizations. They have no legal authority. They may not be illegal. They may not be extra-legal. Everything that they are doing, you know, say they're going to gun ranges and practicing and whatever, that all may be legal. But they don't have any specific legal authority as a militia. To have legal authority as a militia, there has to be a state statute. That's the constitutional pattern, and it was never deviated from. So what I propose, and the book I put out, Constitutional Homeland Security, go to committeesofsafety.org on the web, and you'll find out a lot of information about this, is we need to organize people in groups that are not militia. Don't call themselves militia. They're not militias. They're activist groups, the purpose of which is to get these kinds of statutes passed. Once those statutes are passed, they will lay out the particulars of how people are to join and participate in real militia groups, constitutional militia groups. That's the step. Those folks who are out there advocating doing, going to armed preparation and the rest of it, I think are really doing a disservice to the country as a whole. because they can't get what they want that way, not constitutionally. And they give the other side the opportunity to point to them and say, look at these crazy guys running around in camouflage outfits. The media love that, mass media. But they will never talk about you if you're out there attempting to get a statute passed. They don't want that idea spread at all.
Mm-hmm. So the state itself has to kind of ordain that organization.
Reordain it. So let's stop thinking about this. There is not a disjunction between us and the government. We are the government. The individuals who happen to be there are the people we've sent there for the purpose of performing certain functions for us. In the same way that if I hired a chauffeur and I'm sitting in the back seat, I'm the one in control, theoretically, and I tell him where to go, all right? Our difficulty is we're not taking that kind of control. We draft a statute, the proposal I've put on the table. People get together in a state, they figure out what needs to be done, they find a couple of reasonable lawyers who know how to draft a good statute, they take a model that fits the constitutional pattern, they draft it appropriately for that particular state, they come to those state legislators that they have already cultivated. That's the key to the thing. You have to have your own people there in the state legislature who agree with what you're doing. Here's the statute. We want this enacted. And then they lobby, grassroots lobbying, emails, telephone calls, come down to the state capitol, meet privately with legislators, what have you. They go through all of that grassroots lobbying and get that statute passed. Once that statute has been passed, now who is in control of that situation? Well, it's the militia itself is in control. We now have this institution, and it's now functioning. It's a whole new ball game. See, I'm not coming hat in hand to somebody and say, please, I'd like to have this statute. Please do something for me. My idea is to come to them with a statute and say, we want this passed. We've organized thousands of people. We know you're in favor of it, or if the legislator is not in favor, we know you're not in favor of it, and we want you to think about being in favor of it, because if you turn out not to be in favor of it when this bill comes up and the vote is heard, then at the next election we're going to replace you. And we're going to keep replacing those people who are not in favor of this type of legislation until we get this type of legislation. Because this is so important that we're not going to forget it next year. And we have an election coming up every year, every 2 years, wherever you are, off year or odd year. And at the next election, this is going to be the issue that will make or break your continuation in the legislature, Mr. Representative or Mr. Senator. It's as easy as that. We have 20,000 people who have signed the petition now. Next year, we probably have 40,000. Now, a lot of those people, I think when you talk to them, they'll have enough intelligence to agree with what we're talking about here today. On the merits, I said, yes, that's a good idea. And the ones who are simply careerists will say, I don't know whether it's a good idea or not, but I want to stay in the legislature, and I better go along with my constituents.
Mm-hmm. Now, if we have to go to the states in order to authorize a statute to be passed, then doesn't that put the state itself in the chauffeur's seat, but in the back of the seat? Wouldn't they be in control of the militia at that point?
The militia's in control of the militia. Are you really going to tell me that if you have the majority of people, I care what state you pick, Texas, you have the majority of people in Texas organized this way and recognize their legal constitutional authority to behave in a certain fashion and to take certain action, that they are going to listen to some wayward governor that comes along and tells them to do something contrary to that? See, we're still all living in this country with the myth of the leader principle. That everybody looks up and, this is the guy who was elected governor, this is the guy who was elected president, we have to kind of bow down to this creature. That's not self-government. That's the Hitler system. That's the Mussolini system. They had a name for it in Germany, Das Führerprinzip, the Führer principle, the leader principle. That's what has insinuated itself into this country. And I do not believe that if you get statutes of this kind passed, and to do it, of course, you'll have to educate lots of people, and then those people then become the activists in implementing the statutes, that you will have the leader principle accepted anymore in such a state. It simply will not happen. Now, if you have a good leader, granted, if the governor is a man who's following constitutional principles, fine. If the legislature is following constitutional principles, fine. But if they're not, this great mass of organized people is going to take the appropriate political steps and remove them from office. They're not going to follow them over the edge like lemmings.
is there some connecting network between these local and state militias that's already in place?
No. The idea right now is to form local groups within each state because of the necessity to enact a statute that's essentially tailor-made for the state. Now, I would hope committees of safety is probably the example. The man in charge is a man by the name of Walter Reddy, and Walter's idea is to serve as a clearinghouse for information from each of the states so that people in, you know, Arizona can see what's working in Montana or what isn't working, whatever, and then apply that in their own locale. And obviously the first state that is successful in this type of organization is going to be a bellwether and model for others to follow along. But basically the idea is state by state, because in the Constitution, what are the militia called? The militia of the several states. That's the title given to them. They're state institutions. Each state has its or her own militia. There is no national militia. Militia of the United States, that doesn't exist. So we have to think, and this is the federal principle, right? We're talking now about federalism in its basic form. We have a pyramidal structure. You have the Washington, D.C. government, which is to perform certain national functions. Then below that, you have the state governments, which are supposed to perform all of the other functions. Right? And then below that, at the very bottom, the thing that supports the whole structure, the people themselves, and they are organized in this final, this last-ditch institution called the militia, which handles all of the really serious, potentially really serious problems, and serves as the political focal point for people to be vigilant with respect to the upper levels of the political structure. And you can see the genius of this. I mean, I didn't invent this. I'm not giving myself credit for this. The genius for this came from the founding fathers, who had looked back and were great students of history, and a lot of this history came out of their own experience in the colonial period, 100 and something years of colonial experience. It's pretty easy to see how they structured it, and if you actually read the material, you'll see why they structured it that way. And then you see the other important thing is that if you don't do it that way, this whole constitutional structure that we have is like it's kind of like an internal combustion engine in a sense. All the parts fit together according to a plan. And they all have to be at a certain level of repair and in a certain tune for the thing to run. And to the extent you get a little corruption in there, well, that's like knocking in the engine, right? The engine's starting to knock, and the piston rings are starting to loosen and so forth and so on. Well, if you let that go far enough, you end up with major repair problems. But let's take one aspect of this. If you pull the carburetor off that machine or the fuel injectors off of that machine, it won't run. All right? And fundamentally, the militia structures, which are the organization of all of the sovereign people, are in that position. They're something as important as the carburetor or the pistons or the crankshaft. You pull that out of the structure, and yeah, the thing may still continue to turn for a while, but eventually it'll stop or shake itself to pieces, one way or the other, because you've pulled out one of the fundamental operating parts of the mechanism. This Constitution, nothing was kind of thrown together. It's a structure, political structure, that they built with all of the parts integrated. And if you pull one out or you fail to use it properly, the rest of the system is going to suffer. Now we're seeing the consequences of it. We've seen the consequences of it on a number of occasions, but not as thoroughly as it's occurring now. I mean, now the thing is shaking itself to pieces. We've gotten to that point. And the alternative is, well, okay, you take a chance. Maybe you organize these militias, and maybe they'll all turn out to be a bunch of dopes, and they'll agree with whatever crackpot politician becomes governor or president, and you know the system will just be just as bad as it is today. Okay, that's one possibility. Can't exclude that entirely. But the alternative is this country's going to be destroyed. It's going to be destroyed economically. They're doing a pretty good job of that right now. And then they're going to follow that on with some kind of financial police state, socialist or fascist in nature. And all of your freedoms are going to go down the drain. That's a prediction. You know, you can take that to the bank. Absolutely true. That is coming. So what's the alternative? To sit down and watch it happen, or to do something else that has a chance, at least as the Constitution tells us, that has a chance of restoring and preserving a free state? What do you got against rolling the dice? If you don't roll the dice, you're going to lose all your money anyway. Because there's somebody else at the table that's going to roll the dice if you don't. And he's going to roll loaded dice, by the way. Your money is on the table. He has loaded dice, and now they're passing the cup to you and asking you whether you want to take a chance. And I would say, well, I would roll the good dice before I'd let this guy roll the loaded dice.
Now, where do people that are listening to the call right now, either the recording or the live call, go? We talked about committees of safety and some of the websites. Can you list off some of the websites people need to go to get educated about this, including your own?
Well, if they want to tie this all in together with the present economic crisis, and these things are really not separate, they should go to newswithviews.com, newswithviews, all one word, .com. And on the web homepage, on the left-hand side, there's a contributor list, and my name is in there. And pull that up, and you'll see if you start from the first one on that list, because I start talking about